मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहं न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमेन तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातुर्न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु शिवानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं
Good afternoon, good evening. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all, to welcome all of us, including myself, to this second class in Transforming the Mind, in this incredibly profound and subtle and yet powerfully practical teaching based on the Yoga Vasishtha, the great text of medieval Vedanta. I also wanted to say, and it's kind of a passing observation, but also we're going to be working with it a little bit, that today happens to be the 100th anniversary of the founding of the New Thought Movement, which is, as we said last week, it's a conglomeration of teachings, including science of mind, religious science, unity, the various large and small ways of looking at the world, that are fundamentally based on the teaching of Vedanta, of the Yoga Vasishtha, actually, even though many of the founders of these different movements aren't aware of it. But it's fundamentally a teaching about the infinitely creative power of consciousness and mind, which Western thinkers adapted from the originals, brought to the West, and you know, in keeping with the American tendency to make everything very practical and applicable to daily life, turned it into a series of teachings for overcoming the tendencies of the human mind to limit ourselves by believing in our materiality. So part of the power of this teaching, I've always felt, rests on the fact that it is so closely connected to the transmission, to the truth that comes through texts like the Yoga Vasishtha and through some of the Kashmir Shaiva Tantric texts that we often study. This recognition that this universe is infinitely subtle consciousness manifesting as all that is a teaching that can transform us in an instant. So one of the things that I've really loved about all of our classes, but particularly about this last class, is that the conversation that you guys have been creating on the listserv is such an amazing satsang. And it's so clear how when people get together in community and practice with a kind of serious willingness to apply these subtle teachings day after day, both in sitting meditation and in contemplating the way our lives are unfolding, that the conversation that we can have together is really equal to the conversation of sages. It is the conversation of sages, in fact. So what we are experiencing here together, and this is as true for those of you who are listening in tomorrow or next week as it is for those of us who are here live, what we're experiencing really is the power of satsang. And we're going to speak a little bit more today about satsang as Vasishtha talks about it, and also about some of the other, what he calls gatekeepers to the state of liberation. But first, let's bring ourselves fully here into the present moment, which, as we all know, is the only moment in which we can awaken. So as you bring your awareness into your body, see if you can hold your mind with the breath and let the inhalation flow down towards the lower belly. And then with the exhalation, see if you can allow the exhalation to be deep and long so that the old dead air flows out of your lungs. And let each breath, in each inhalation, draw your attention deeper into the body. And with the exhalation, you might just pull your belly in just a little bit to help you exhale the air. And one more time, deep inhalation, and then a full exhalation. And letting your awareness, your attention, return to the breath. See if with the next exhalation, you can have the thought, I accept what is inside my body and mind at this moment. And accepting it, I let go of my attachment to it, of my identification with it. Just have this thought. And notice if there's a mood or a sense of the energy in your body. Maybe you feel very calm or irritable, or maybe you feel very open and excited, or maybe some part of you is stressed or contracted or worried. So let whatever state you're in be as it is. Widen your awareness so that you're conscious not only of the breath and your inner state and my voice, but also the whole room you're in. And now become aware of all of us who are present here in this moment on the live call, and there are quite a few of us from all over the continent and some from Europe, and become aware, if you're listening in at a later time, of all these consciousnesses that are present here in this space with us. And by entering into this subtle community, understand that we are literally being supported and nourished by the intention of consciousness to awaken us, the intention that flows through and is enhanced and augmented to an extraordinary extent by our shared intention. Recognizing that this intention for awakening, which in Sanskrit is called anugraha, which we normally translate as grace, it's inherent in your mind. It's inherent in the mind of the universe, in the mind of the Tao. So as we allow ourselves to surrender into our bodies, into the breath, into the acceptance of where we are and who we are in this moment, and into our intention for freedom, understand that consciousness, which is creating fresh experience in every moment, is so delighted to manifest as the community of awakening beings, as the process of awakening, and as the manifold experiences that are bringing each of us more and more deeply into unity with that awareness that's become us. So, with your awareness in the body, with the breath, and also with your sense of the community of the Sangam, of the Satsang, we're going to speak the words of a prayer that I sent you, and for those of you who were able to download it and print it, great. For those of you who weren't, no worries. It's there in your folder, and I'm going to say it out loud, and you can follow along and think it to yourself. We're going to say it in English, although I will say the first verse in Sanskrit. It goes, Yatha sarvani bhutani pratibanti stitani cha yatrevo pasanam yanti tasmai satyatmane namaha. Salutations to that reality in which all the elements and all sentient and insentient beings shine, to that allness in which all sentient, all elements and all sentient and insentient beings shine as if they had an independent existence, in which they exist for a time and into which they merge. So we salute that reality, and in Sanskrit, the phrase is Tasmai Satyatmane Namaha. Satyatmane means the pure self, the true self, the self which is Sat, which is pure being. So let's just say it. You can say it out loud or inwardly. Tasmai Satyatmane Namaha. Tasmai Satyatmane Namaha. Tasmai Satyatmane Namaha. Which means salutations to that self, which is pure being. And then the second verse goes, salutations to that consciousness, and the Sanskrit there is tasmai jnanabdhyatmane namaha. Tasmai jnanabdhyatmane namaha. Tasmai jnanabdhyatmane namaha. Salutations to that consciousness which is the source of the distinct threefold divisions of knower, knowledge, and known, of seer, seeing, and seen, and of doer, doing, and deed. Tasmai jnanatmane namaha. Jnanatmane really means the self as knowledge, the ultimate self as that knowledge which is the source of our experience of a subject which knows, of the process of knowing, and of the objects of knowledge, of first, second, and third person experience of life. All of it arises out of that jnanatmane, that consciousness, that self as consciousness. And the third line goes, the final words of the third line are tasmai Brahmanat Brahmanandatmane namaha. Tasmai Brahmanatmane namaha. Salutations to that ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings. Anandasya mbare wanau, whose happiness is derived from the shower of spray, from that ocean of bliss. The word for the shower of spray is sphuranti. It's literally means that which rises upward, which rises out of the ocean of bliss. Tasmai Brahmanandatmane namaha. Salutations to the self which is the bliss of the absolute. So, and in the end we say, Om Tat Sat, Om Namah Shivaya. And with your eyes closed, offer your practice, asking that it be of benefit to all beings in all worlds and to the earth itself. Salutations to that ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings, whose happiness is derived from the shower of spray from that ocean of bliss. Our happiness, this line says, comes from just a tiny fragment of that ocean of bliss, which we experience even in our state of ignorance and bondage, if you don't mind my using the words of the text. All of our happiness, just as all of our awareness, is actually an aspect of that awareness and blissfulness, which is the nature of reality itself. Oh my God. So, your attention flows with the breath as it flows in and out of the nostrils. Let yourself focus fully on the breath. And see if you can fasten your mind, focus your mind on the energy flowing in and out of your nostrils, right at the tip of the nostrils. This is a practice of sama, that is to say, of equanimity. It's one of the essential practices for coming into tranquility, which is the first gatekeeper at the doorway of the house of liberation. Sama means, variously translated as equanimity, tranquility, control. Those are all ways of translating it. It's the root of the word samadhi, which means equanimity of the very mind stuff itself, absorption. So one of the preliminary practices for experiencing tranquility or pacification of mind, which is the first gatekeeper to the doorway of liberation, to the city of liberation, is just to bring your mind gently to the experience of breath flowing in cold, cool, to the tip of the nostrils, coolish, and warm as it flows out the tip of the nostrils. You're just focusing there at the nostrils. And of course, the mind will get distracted, or perhaps not. And if it does, you just gently bring it back to the tip of the nostrils and the flow of the breath. So your awareness is settling more and more deeply into the felt experience of the air flowing into the very edge, the very tip of the nostrils, the sensation of it, the little caress of the breath, the slight coolness of the breath going in, the warmth going out, just staying there at the tip of the nostrils. Now see if you can bring your awareness into the breath so that you actually enter into the breath as it comes in to the nostrils and flow with the breath as far down into the body as it wants to go. It's almost as though you've rolled your attention into a little ball and entered into the flow of breath, and you're sailing down the breath flow from the nostrils down into the body. And then as the exhalation rises, you flow as this little ball of awareness up and out the nostrils, and then again, your awareness dives into the breath as if you're riding the river of breath. Down and back up, and of course it's not you as the body that's flowing with the breath. It's you as awareness, you as attention, you as the capacity for, let's call it focus, your attention. Your attention has rolled itself up into a little ball of awareness that is flowing on the stream of breath. Noticing how the breath stream is cool as it flows in and warmer as it flows out. And as the mind gets distracted, even if it's just wondering if you're doing it the right way, bring it back, just gently bring it back. Gently refocus inside the breath. Now see if you can allow your awareness inside the breath to expand. So now it's as if the breath expands out from your nostrils through your throat. With the inhalation, it expands out to fill your whole body. And your attention expands with the breath. Seeing how large, how much of the body the breath can fill from inside. The breath flows in and your awareness with it, expanding through the body. And with the exhalation, you feel the breath expanding out through the pores of the body. And your attention, again, it's flowing in with the breath, with the prana. Expanding through the body, breath, as it were filling the body, and with the exhalation flowing outward, flowing out through your pores. How big can your awareness be? And if there's strain in this, if your mind is worrying about whether it's doing it correctly, just have the thought of letting that go. Coming into the breath, flowing in and filling up the body. Flowing out through the body, expanding out with the exhalation. And one thing that you may notice as you settle into the breath, and I'm not suggesting that you stop. You can please continue just flowing with the breath as I'm speaking. As we follow together this practice of coming into the body and allowing the breath to expand through the body, we are also beginning to open up to the possibility that this body, which ordinarily seems dense and even uncomfortable, is actually filled with space. The breath, the prana, the energy, the life energy, the vital force inside the breath can begin to teach our body its own spaciousness. As the breath expands our attention out beyond the skin boundaries. And perhaps we can also, as we kind of let the breath cuddle inside us and open up inside us, perhaps we can just stay with the awareness that on an even subtler level than the prana, on an even subtler level than the energy that's flowing through the breath and also through the body, this body is not only a unity of cells, it's also united with everything in the universe, even on a physical level. I just heard a little talk by an astrophysicist, Neil deGrasse, who said, with apologies to you, Sherilyn, if I'm getting this wrong, who said that for him, the most astounding fact of this universe is that all the atoms of living beings are made of the stuff that came from inside ancient stars that millions and millions and millions of years ago exploded, scattering their materials across the universe in the form of hydrocarbons and other elemental particles. And these became space dust, and the space dust became galaxies and suns and also living beings. So those same particles, those same subtle elements from inside those exploding suns are literally inside our bodies and inside the bodies of all living beings in the earth. So physically, we are unity. Our body and the universe are made out of the same stuff. And at the same time, on the deeper level, what we're learning here is that just as oneness, unity, can be discovered through the physical sciences, through cosmology and even biology, through awareness, through the eye of the heart, the eye of spirit, this entire system in which forms are constantly emerging and then dissolving into energies that are then reused for another emergence. All this at an essential level is arising within a vast mind. This is the view of the Yoga Vasishtha. This is the teaching of the Yoga Vasishtha. And I want to read for you before we go into some of the methodology that's behind this sadhana. I want to read for you a few lines from the Yoga Vasishtha. The infinite consciousness simultaneously pervades the three periods of time, past, present, and future, and experiences the infinite worlds. So all of those old stars that exploded and became this are pervaded, were pervaded, will be pervaded with that infinite consciousness. This consciousness experiences simultaneously what is sweet and what is bitter. It is tranquil and at peace. Because this consciousness is in itself free from all modifications, all qualities, and because it is subtle and experiences all things at the same time, it is ever at peace and homogeneous, even while apparently experiencing the diversity of diverse phenomena. So this is you. This is your consciousness. It experiences what is free, what is sweet, and what is bitter. That is, the pleasure and pain in your physical and mental and emotional existence is simultaneously being experienced by that one consciousness, which is yourself and also the self within all that is. When the apparently transformed becoming, that's us, resorts to or rests on that being which has not undergone any modification, in other words, when our mind, which is of course, in a constant state of becoming, rests in being. The former is freed from sorrow. The mind is freed from sorrow. And when what is seen by what is not, or by, that is, by the mind in which there's no movement, that which is abandons its negative qualities. When consciousness abandons the perception of past, present, and future, when it is freed from being tied to objectivity or conceptualization, it rests in utter tranquility. It is beyond description. Whether there is a self or not, that which is not subject to dissolution is the supreme liberation. On account of thought, on account of the modifications of the mind, this consciousness is apparently veiled. But it's never divided. I salute the self, salutations to myself, the undivided consciousness, the jewel of all the seen and unseen worlds. You have been touched. You have been gained. So, here we are, contemplating the amazing fact that this consciousness, this amazing, untransformed, unmodified awareness is manifesting completely as you and I. And as you listen to what we're going to be saying, which is a continuation of the story of Queen Leela that we began last week, just imagine that you are listening not only as your individual self with your personal history and everything that goes on with you, you're also listening as that consciousness which is recognizing itself in this extraordinary teaching that Goddess Saraswati is giving to Queen Leela. So if you'll remember, in last week's class, we told a part of the story of Queen Leela, who was so in love with her husband that when she realized that he was going to die, she prayed to the Goddess Saraswati for help and received some boons. First of all, one of the boons was that her husband's body would remain in her room without decaying. And secondly, that she would get to travel with Saraswati through different times and different universes to see her former and future lives with her husband. And we ended with this piece in which Saraswati has taken her to the hut of a holy man and shown her that this holy man had decided at one point that he wanted to be a king, and so was born as a king. So his mind had the strength, she explains, to manifest a life as a king. And this is really important, because his mind had become so one with consciousness that he could create different identities and have them become real. So Saraswati tells the queen, It is if your husband in his last incarnation went to sleep and dreamed a dream in which he saw himself as a king. So you and your husband are actually the dream creations of this holy man. And she's going to go on to say that this truth of Leela and her husband being the dream creations of the holy man is also true of us. But just consider this for a minute in terms of our daily experience. Have you ever had someone call you and say, you were in my dream and you were doing this, and, you know, actually I saw that you were getting married to so-and-so and I thought I should tell you because I think there might be a message to you? And sometimes it may be, but truthfully, most of the time, the message that your friend got in her dream has nothing to do with you, because the version of you that appears in that person's dream is actually a creation of her own consciousness. It's, you know, in Jung's terms, it's a manifestation of her unconscious. So, you know, when somebody tells me that I've been in their dream, and very often they take it very seriously, you know, often they get a warning or something of that kind that they feel like they need to pass on to me. And occasionally it's actually been true, because that's the other thing about dreams. There are many kinds of dreams. But at the same time, most of the time, I can't get into your dream and you can't get into my dream, except insofar as my consciousness has some aspect of my personal unconscious that is represented by you, which then creates you in my dream so that I can experience that part of myself. But that process that goes on in the individual is also going on in the great consciousness, in the mind of, let's say, the great holy man or woman who is dreaming this universe, and who, of course, has no body, but, you know, is simply that vast consciousness. I mean, just let this crazy idea blow your mind. So one of the ways that we know that there actually is such a thing as a consciousness that transcends our individual consciousness is through dreams, because there are some dreams that don't feel, as I said earlier, like products of our own individual consciousness. They really do seem to have been downloaded from some higher realm, and I think you all know what I mean. You know, maybe the light is very bright, or there's a deep transmission of wisdom, which sometimes we can't even remember when we wake up, but in the dream, it's really mind-blowing and sometimes life-transforming. Or we see a vision of a holy person or a sage or a teacher. I think many of you, like many people I know, actually received initiation from a teacher or a guru in the dream. Some of you I know have met one of the teachers of my lineage in dreams and received instruction and even awakening from them. And the question that always comes up is, did the guru do it on purpose? In other words, if somebody is so showing up in your dreams, that a powerful, holy being is showing up in your dreams, did they do it on purpose? Did they deliberately come into your dreams? And the answer, like everything else in the teachings of the Yoga Vasishtha, is maybe yes, maybe no, or sometimes and sometimes not. When I was in with my teachers, people would often tell them these amazing stories. Someone would say, I was having a massage, and I went into a sort of a dream state, and suddenly this dark-skinned man in orange clothes was standing in front of me, and I was filled with love. And 3 days later, I saw the picture in my girlfriend's house, and she told me that that was a picture of Swami Muktananda, and here I am. Or I was in Kathmandu. This really happened to a friend of mine. Suddenly the fan, I was lying in my hotel room with malaria, the fan started saying, go to Muktananda. And for an entire day, the fan was saying that to me, and I'd never heard of Muktananda, but so I asked around the cafes, and I found out about the ashram here in outside of Bombay, and here I am. And invariably, you know, Muktananda would welcome that person very warmly. And at the same time, you knew that he was just as surprised and delighted as the person was. In other words, he hadn't gone and talked, spoken through the fan, or literally appeared in the massage therapist's room to give that person a vision. And yet that person often would be really set on the spiritual path by that experience. When I was with Gurumai, Muktananda's successor, whom some of you know and others may have heard of, she used to talk about this and how it worked. And she often said that when she appeared in someone's dream, it wasn't that she'd made a decision. She actually told me once, the guru just stays in his own state, and consciousness does everything on its own. So, in other words, we could say that when someone appears in our dreams, anyone, it's consciousness communicating something to us. It's, in a case like that, what's happening is that natural, the f- function of consciousness to bestow grace, to give grace, to reveal your inner truth to you, which is called anugraha in Sanskrit, is actually appearing in that form. And this is why in Kashmir Shaivism, in one of the commentaries written by the tantric sage Kshema Raja, it said very famously, the guru, the teacher, the preceptor, as they say in Vedanta, is the grace-bestowing power of the divine. In other words, the guru is not the physical person. The guru is that grace-bestowing power that's transmitted through the teacher. And any true transmission, whether it comes from a guru or from a text like this one or through satsang, through a community, is happening from the grace-bestowing power of God, of consciousness. And that's why, that's what makes it true. So the guru or the teacher or the scripture is the vehicle. And the same is true of deities. In fact, Saraswati is going to say this to Leela a little bit later on. Leela actually asks Saraswati, about her blessing. And Saraswati says, I am the power of grace that takes this form. I myself love deities. I often feel that I can feel the individuality of a particular energy, a particular deity energy. And I know that many of you have had similar experiences. But that energy we experience as deity is actually a flavor. Let's call it a collection of thoughts condensed into a form that we experience as a channel for blessings. And that energy, the energy of deity or the energy of teacher, will remain with us in form for a certain time as long as we need it. But at a certain point, it becomes apparent that all the forms that we call deity or God and the forms that we call teacher are all just emergent out of that function of consciousness which awakens us, which bestows grace. So Leela and Saraswati are standing there, and Saraswati tells Leela, you and your husband are creations of this holy man in his consciousness, and because he had this power to create himself in another body, and his hut and your palace are in the same place, just in different times, because space and time are infinitely malleable when we are in the eternal now. All times are present in the present moment, in pure nowness. So, I just want to flag that for a moment. Let's take a moment and practice with that. Close your eyes if they're not already closed. And let's practice coming into the present moment by focusing on the silence between these words, which is the space between one word and another, in which, as we focus, we can come to a sense of timelessness, of just being here. So let my words arise and subside, and you focus in between them. And understand what Saraswati is saying to Leela in this moment is that when we are poised in that space of the now, and if we can stay there, then we are in the place in consciousness where the source code is being written. Such as if you degree that you can stay poised in that space of awareness between one thought and another, and fully enter it, you can literally rewrite the source code of your life. So, in this state, Leela comes back to her palace. She's been to this previous incarnation, and she suddenly wakes up. She enters into that recognition of space between here and there, and she sees, you know how when we talk about these deep inner realizations, we use the language of vision. We see. She saw that in this very place she'd been a holy man's wife, a queen, and she also saw that her husband, whose dead body was in her room, was in another dimension, still alive and ruling the kingdom. And she says to Saraswati, "Oh my God, I remember everything. I have been a dog, an elephant, a celestial being, a mountain, a snake, a mosquito, a queen. I've been so many things." And she sees that she, in all these forms, is a thought arising in the space of consciousness. And in all her other incarnations, she sees, they were all thoughts. Or let's say collections of thoughts. So that consciousness which has the thought, I'm a mosquito or I'm an elephant, is actually consciousness identifying itself with the body, with the concept of the body. And of course, we have this experience in life when we identify so firmly with our social role. You know, you're a teenager, you're free of obligations, then you become a PhD, and then you fall in love and get married, and suddenly you're in this whole world of dharmas, of obligations. You're in the archetype of husband and father, and your sense of who you are is completely governed by how competent you are in that role. But then suppose you get divorced, and you move to another city, and a few years pass, you look back on that marriage, especially if there are no kids, and it feels like a dream. It feels like it happened to another person. And this is actually a phenomenon of consciousness, that when our identification with something dissolves, then we are no longer that reality. Even though, you know, that reality, that memory is somewhere in our brain and could be brought back if necessary, but in our now experience, you're not that person anymore, just as you're not the five-year-old. And this idea is fundamental to the process of self-reflection that's at the heart of the Yoga Vasishtha. Saraswati says to Leela, and again, what I'm going to tell you is not a new teaching, it's just a reminder. Because this is what this text is for. It's to remind you. All these things, she says, become apparent realities. We take these bodies, this world appears, because cosmic consciousness has infinite power within it. There's consciousness everywhere and Shakti everywhere. Only because we're conceptually limited by our egoic identification with our body, our personal history, our various identities, that we remain stuck in this historical reality. It's all about identification. So according to Vasishtha, all this is someone's dream. Whatever happens in this world happens in that dream. So if you've ever had a lucid dream and had the experience of waking up in the dream, you know that dream can go on. And you can live through the dream and at the same time be aware that it's a dream. The dream characters don't disappear. But you recognize that the dream is a dream and it's going on inside you. If you're really good at lucid dreaming, you realize that all the objects in your dream are part of your consciousness. So what the Vishishta Yoga would say is that if, when we examine our dreams, not in order to get information about our unconscious from them, which you can also do, but in the Vedantic way, you realize that just as characters in dreams seem real when they're actually projections of our own consciousness, our lives too seem very real, but in fact they're part of a longer dream and all of us are characters in it. So again, bring your attention back to the breath. Be present with the breath flowing in and out of the nostrils. Let your mind settle with the breath. And as thoughts arise, just keep bringing the mind back to the breath. And with your attention on the breath, ask yourself this question. Am I inside this room, or is this room inside me? Is my awareness inside this building, or is this building inside my awareness? Not because you're going to get an answer in words, but because that's one of the questions that can begin to arouse recognition of that which is deeper than your thinking and your assumptions. This practice that we have just been doing, as I told you earlier, is one of the practices of Sama, or the practice of creating tranquility or control of mind. And it's one of the four gatekeepers to the City of Liberation. And I want to just spend a few minutes talking about them, because really, when we look at them, we see that they are the basis of our practice. And to recognize that the practices that we do, the practices that help us to awaken and stay awake and live with the ups and downs of life with the kind of awareness that allows us to accept, transcend, and experience blissfulness and awareness in the midst of them, these are all practices that Vishishta includes in these four basic gatekeepers. So these teachings, these practices are really they're the keys to liberation. And they are, I'll give you the Sanskrit and the English and then we'll go through them. The first is Sama, which as we know means tranquility. It's usually translated as control of the mind. Control of the mind means the ability to be tranquil in the midst of God knows what else is going on. The second is called vichara, which literally means inquiry, and which is essentially the practice that we've been doing this week and last week, and that question that we just asked ourselves, is awareness, am my awareness inside the room, or is the room inside me? Is it vichara? It's an inquiry. Vichara is literally the practice of asking yourself questions about the nature of reality and allowing the answers to emerge not from your ordinary mind, but from the source of mind itself. The third practice is called santosha, which means contentment, but which I'd like to talk about really as the attitude of accepting what is. And the fourth is called sadhu satsanga, which literally means the company of sadhus, of holy people, of practitioners, of people on the journey, of the teachings, and the company of the wise. What we're doing here is sadhu satsanga. We're keeping company with each other. We're keeping company with this great, great sage and teacher. And we're also keeping company with the wisdom of our own higher awareness. And I also want to give a shout out to Swami Venkateshananda, the translator of this text, which is not an easy text to put into understandable English, and which really, the way we receive it, it's been filtered through his extraordinary, very awakened consciousness. He was a student of one of the greatest teachers of modern India, Swami Sivananda, who was also the guru of Swami Satchidananda and Swami Vishnu Devananda and some of the teachers who brought yoga to the West. And he was just a great, great exponent of Vedanta, who managed to speak about it and write about it and translate it in a way that we could really take in. So, gratitude to him. And santosha, the practice of accepting what is actually happening in your reality right now, letting go of your resistance to what is, I'd like to invite you to do that right now, and of your frustrations because life isn't what you'd like it to be. Or alternatively, that thing we do of going, oh my God, I'm so happy. I'm having such a good time. I love this person so much. Oh, please don't let it end. Don't let it end. Being able to avoid both resisting what's unpleasant and clinging to what's pleasant is santosha. And as we know, it's a very transformative practice and really hard to do. And yet, once we manage to do it, it just changes everything. I have a torn rotator cuff at the moment, and it's kind of painful. And it also is extremely annoying because it means that I can't do yoga, really. I can't do down dog or, you know, any pose that asks me to lift my arms. So, you know, if you're a person who does a lot of yoga, you know that we depend on our yoga for a certain degree of high prana well-being. So it actually, when we can't do yoga, it demands a lot more practice of different kinds. And what I've discovered in this process is that if I resist the pain, not only does the pain get worse, but I feel really cranky. And if I can say to myself, okay, let it be as it is, it's okay for it to be as it is, then the entire physical experience opens up. And I know that a lot of you do this practice. It's a tremendously, just in and of itself, liberating practice. And in fact, this moment of complete acceptance was the secret of Byron Katie's enlightenment, which has had such an effect on the modern world. You know, if you know her story, she was an alcoholic. She was in rehab for some kind of substance addiction. And one day she woke up on the floor of her funky room with a cockroach crawling up her arm and went, ew, as one would. And then she suddenly accepted it. She had a moment of going, okay, this is reality. This is how it is. It's really how it is. And it's okay for it to be as it is because that's how it is. And this was an awakening, which in her case seems to have not gone away. And her teaching, her basic teaching, is really about accepting reality. you know, if you say my husband should love me more, she says, why? Is that really true? Should he love you more? Or is the way he loves you simply the way reality is manifesting? And for people who are caught in the incredible judgmental comparative state of the mind, this is utterly liberating in this moment. And as many of you know, there are quite a few teachers these days, especially in my neighborhood in Northern California, who basically teach, okay, you're not happy with yourself. Okay, you know, you feel wounded. Okay, you're lonely. So can you let that be all right? Can you let it be okay that you're lonely? Can you let it be okay that your girlfriend left you? Can you let it be okay that you're never going to be able to fix yourself? You know, can you just let that be as it is? And somehow, if you can let yourself relax into that awareness of physical pain or your worry about the rent, and just accept it, let it be as it is, all by itself, that relaxes so many of the knots in the mind. And hopefully, as I've been talking, you've been playing with it, experimenting with it. So, Santosha is that quality of acceptance. It is as it is. I can accept it, which also happens to be the first step to change. Sama, control of mind or tranquility, is really the basis of meditation practice. And we've been doing some sama today, and we're going to do a little bit more of it. In some of the commentaries on the Yoga Vasishtha, this word sama is translated as strength, because in modern times we really don't like to speak about control. Control is kind of a bad word in contemporary consciousness in the West. But the truth is that some ability to control the mind, which actually means to let the mind, to know how to let the mind settle down, is utterly and absolutely necessary to a sustained awakening. There's just no substitute for, you know, the exercise of bringing the mind back inside and getting it to settle. But there are ways to do this that are actually potentially successful, and ways to do this that are just going to make you crazy. So part of what I've tried to discover in my years of meditating, for me, the big thing, the big discovery was, how can I find the place where my mind isn't running all over the place, which is what it likes to do if I don't pay attention to it, and holding my mind in a knot that actually creates more contraction. And this, of course, it's really the basic paradox in your practice, is how do we, let's use the word, how do we control the tendency of the mind to go all over the place without creating the struggle and tension that comes from the fact that actually the mind cannot be controlled. And that's, you know, this whole understanding of Vasishthas is all about, it's this, but it's also that. It takes effort, but it also only happens through grace. We have to control the mind, but the mind can't be controlled. So the practice of sama in Tibetan Buddhism, their core meditation is called samatha, or literally the ta part means making the mind, pacifying the mind. It means making the mind quiet. It's the quality of quieting the mind. So what we do in practicing sama is, first of all, to just keep bringing attention back to the practice, back to the breath, back to the mantra, back to noticing the spaciousness within which awareness can expand, back to the sushumna nadi, back to the invocation of the deity, whatever it is that we're doing, the mind is going to leap out of it and we just gently bring it back. And so that's our effort, that's our practice. And that's a kind of a duh, that's what we learn in meditation practice. You know, every meditation teacher will tell you, focus on the breath, and then when the mind goes away, just gently bring it back. But here's the thing, and this is the transformative secret, and those of you who have been part of this satsang for a while know this because I talk about it all the time. No effort that you make is going to get the mind to stop thinking. My guru used to say, the mind won't stop thinking just because you want it to. In fact, if you try to get the mind to stop thinking, it's just going to resist you, because the nature of the mind is creative consciousness itself, as we have been saying. Your mind is made of that same infinitely powerful awareness that has created this universe. Oh my God! So, of course, it's going to create inner universes. There's no way that you can get it to stop doing that. But the secret, which is one of the deep truths of Tantra, is one of the reasons that Tantra is such a fabulous, practical field of study. The thing that Tantra tells us is just recognize what the mind is, even as you're doing your sama practice, you're bringing the mind back to the point, back to the breath. You also remind yourself, okay, my mind is made of consciousness. It's filled with particles of consciousness. And wherever my mind goes, even to thoughts, even to the pain in my knee, it's consciousness. If you took the Vijnanabhairava course the last few months, you remember the dharana, wherever my mind goes, inside or outside, everywhere is the state of Shiva. Everything, everywhere my mind goes is consciousness. So that's how we practice control of mind. We make the concentrated effort in practice, which becomes subtler and subtler as we get more experienced. But we also remember and keep remembering that the mind that we're trying to tame is the great consciousness herself, who is not tameable because she's the boss. In fact, if you don't mind my personalizing that which is radically impersonal. So we give up trying to control even as we're practicing. And with that paradoxical balance, we come to equilibrium. We actually trigger the grace factor in consciousness. So let's do it. And we're going to do it in a kind of classical way. You're focusing in the nostrils. And if you're anything like me, there's something very soothing and settling about bringing your attention to this, the breath flowing in and out of the tips of the nostrils. And maybe you're just completely present with that. That's great. But for the sake of practicing sama as it's classically done, let's try it like this. Focus completely for 7 breaths, the full length of the breath. The breath flows in and your mind flows with it in touching the nostrils. And you stay with the breath as far down as it goes, and then the breath flows out. And you stay with the breath. For one breath. Two breaths. Three breaths. And if the mind wanders, you remind yourself, wherever my mind goes, is consciousness. These very wanderings are happening within the great mind, which is made of divine awareness, and then just bring it back. Four breaths. Three more breaths. Stay present. A few more breaths. And you can stay with the breath as we talk about the practice of vichara. Vichara is the core of the Yoga Vishishta. It's the core of Vedanta. Vichara, which literally means inquiry or self-questioning. And we've been working with vichara, practicing on focusing awareness on awareness, opening out from a particular portal in the physical body. The Ajna Chakra entered from behind the palate. And some of you have shared that this practice has been a big opener for you. Some have found it difficult. Several people have said that it's actually easier to tune into awareness through the heart. And I want to say this is fine. The back of the heart, the area behind the heart center, is also a portal into awareness. And for many of you, it just might feel more blissful, more sweet. But the truth is that great as this practice is, and I personally really love it, the center itself, the chakra or the Ajna chakra or the heart chakra, or wherever you find your doorway, is actually simply a seat. It's a way of locating ourselves within the body, literally seating ourselves at one of the gateways or doorways that can allow us to slip into awareness. What matters, what's significant here, what makes it the chara, is the act of letting yourself be aware of awareness, move into awareness. In fact, the practice in the center is sama. It's, you know, it's actually one of the tricks we do for letting the mind settle. The vichara is the awareness of awareness. And so inquiry is the question of, okay, what is my awareness? What's the difference between that part of my mind that has become a thought and the part of my mind which is powering that thought, which is the background to that thought? Noticing, okay, there's a thought, and then that thought is arising inside a field. Can I find the field behind and within the thought? And maybe there's some stillness. Actually inquiring into your own awareness. What does awareness look like? you can look at awareness even though it's very subtle. Even though looking at awareness might kind of blow your concepts about what it is that you're looking at. How far does awareness extend? All those are vicharas. And the other practice, of course, it's the classical practice of vichara. One of the most ancient practices is the inquiry, who am I really? Or what am I, which is how I like to do it. And you, in this practice, you really look deeply into what you identify as yourself. And see if by asking, what am I or who am I, you can discover that in you which is foundational. What's unchanging, what's unconditioned, what is, let's say, the true self and not subject to time and death. And in the tradition, the song that we play at the beginning and the end of the class actually explains this practice. It says, I'm not my mind, I'm not my breath, I'm not the mantra, I'm not my organs, I'm not my sexual experience, I'm not the student, I'm not the guru, I'm nothing, I am consciousness and bliss. So, you know, it's in vichara, in real vichara, you ask, what am I? And with the understanding, and this is where the teaching comes in, that what you're looking for is that which is real, which is sat chit ananda, which is unconditionally present, which is naturally intelligent. And you recognize that that can't be your body because your body is subject to change. It's not your role as a journalist or a mother or your good singing voice or any of those things, because they come and go. It's not your mood or your thoughts. What you're looking for is always the true subject, the subject that can't ever be an object. This is one of the clues. The I, which doesn't identify with anything outside itself, the pure I am. And this kind of self-questioning, if you do it in an innocent way, without thinking, oh, I know the answers, which is what often happens to us, this kind of self-questioning will take you in a very natural way beyond the ego. And so we'll just do it for a moment. Ask yourself, what am I? But with the intention to reject all the verbal answers that come up, so you get the answer, I'm an Anna, or I'm a human being, or I'm consciousness. Reject that answer, because it's words. And just keep asking. What am I? Actually, I'll ask it for you. Who are you? Again, if verbal answers come up, let them go. Who are you? Who are you really? Who are you? If there are no thoughts, if there are no ideas, if there are no memories, who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Are you? as you listen to the question or question yourself, know that this question is addressed not to your mind, but to yourself, to that suchness. Out of which all thoughts, all perceptions are constantly arising, even when they seem to be coming from outside. Who are you? Who are you? Who are you? Who are you? And as you settle into and sink into your own spacious consciousness, I want to tell you a story. That's a story about the quintessence of satsang from the Yoga Vasishtha. And this is the story of Queen Trudala and her husband Shikidwaja. And it's a story that my guru used to tell. In the text, it's a very complicated story. It's very long. It's in the chapter on dissolution. And I'm going to give it to you as a reading assignment. But the story goes like this. I'm giving you now the simple version. There was a queen who lived in a very ancient kingdom with her husband, King Shikidwaja, who is a typical king. He liked to hunt, and of course he ruled the kingdom, and they gave very big parties. But Trudala, in her girlhood, had studied with a sage, and she had become profoundly self-realized, and not only self-realized, she also had all the powers of consciousness. She was what's called in the tradition a siddha, which means a fully accomplished yogi who has not only inner realization, but also the capacity to manifest all sorts of extraordinary things. She could fly. She could take on, she could enter other bodies. She could take on different forms. And she lived her life like a classic Indian wife of the ruling classes. And one day, a holy man came to the palace who gave a stirring talk on self-realization and the truth. And her husband, King Shikidwaja, was dumbstruck. The core of the teaching, the essence of the teaching, was from the Bhagavad Gita, and that teaching is peace follows renunciation. Give up what you're clinging to, and there you'll experience the truth. So the king said to his wife, you know, I'm really longing to follow this teacher's instructions. I want to give up everything and realize the truth. And Trudala said, well, you know, giving up everything, it's not just a matter of throwing away your duties and your job and going off into the forest. It's kind of subtler than that. And the king looked at her and he said, what do you know? You're just a woman. And you're a queen, and you're all dressed up in those beautiful clothes, and you love parties, and don't tell me what the truth is. So Chudala, being very intelligent, just realized that he wasn't going to hear anything from her, and their life went on. And then one day she woke up and she saw that her husband was not by her side. He wasn't in bed. He wasn't in any part of the palace. And she looked with her subtle eye, her wisdom eye. She realized that he had left the palace. He'd thrown off his robes. He'd gone out into the night in an old torn shirt and lungi, a cloth around his waist, taking nothing but a water bottle, a water pot. And he'd gone off to the forest to be a holy man and renounce everything. And so, because she had this omniscient power, she was able to follow him, and she saw him. He built a hut. He cleared a little space in the forest, and he would fill his water at the stream, and he would sit and meditate all day long. And as she looked at him, she realized two things. First, that he was very uncomfortable. You know, the guy had never even gone camping. The stream was full of giardia, and it was giving him dysentery, and sleeping on the ground was incredibly uncomfortable, but he was determined. He was going to do it. And she also realized in her wisdom that it was better to let him learn this on his own. So she went back to her normal form, went back to the palace, and began to rule the kingdom as the queen, and she ruled the kingdom for 13 years. Every now and then she would look in on her husband, and she would realize that he was still struggling, but he still wasn't ready. And then one day she saw that the moment was right, the time was right. And knowing that he would never listen to her as his queen, she took the form of a beautiful young sage whose name was Kumbha, which actually means jar. And she appeared in the forest before him and said to him, "Oh, king, what are you doing?" And the king said, "I'm meditating. I'm seeking self-realization. I want to know the truth." And the sage Kumbha says, "Ah, but you haven't found it yet." The king says, "No, I haven't found it. Can you give me a teaching?" The sage said, "Yes, peace follows renunciation." And the king, and then he disappeared. So the king was very confused. He thought to himself, "Well, I've already renounced my palace, my queen. I'm living in this disgusting hut. I'm drinking muddy water. I'm wearing bark by this time. What more can I renounce?" And he thought, "Well, all right, I'll renounce my hut." So he demolished his hut, threw it in the fire, and now he was sitting under a tree, and it was hot, and the rains came, and insects ate him. It was very uncomfortable. His mind was very disturbed. Several weeks went by, and then the sage appeared again. "How are you?" The king said, "Actually, I'm not so great. I've followed your advice. I've given up my hut, and I still don't have peace." The sage said, "You haven't renounced enough." And he disappeared. So the king, again, "What more can I renounce?" He decided he would throw away his clothes. So he took off his bark clothes. Now he was completely naked. More and more uncomfortable. A few weeks later, Kumbha came back. "How's it going with you?" The king said, "Terrible. It's worse and worse." "Ah," says the sage, "you haven't renounced enough." So this time, the king renounced his water bowl, and now he was drinking water from the river with his hands, and he was starving. And when he realized that with all this renunciation, nothing had changed, he decided that what he was being asked to do was give up his body. So he built a fire. He made three circles around it, which is the custom. And then he was preparing to throw himself into the fire. He was saying his final prayers when suddenly the sage Kumbha appeared in the clearing in front of him and pushed him out of the fire and said, "King, what are you doing?" "I'm going to give up my body," the king said. And Kumbha said, "Your body? What makes you think your body is yours to renounce?" He said, "Your body is the product of the sperm and ovum of your parents, and it sustained itself on the food you've eaten, what in this body is yours? It's made of cells and organisms. You renounced your palace, which didn't belong to you. You renounced your clothes, which were not yours. You renounced your queen, who's an independent person. Now you're about to renounce your body. The only thing that you could possibly renounce that's yours to renounce is your ego, your sense of identification with your personal physical self. Give up that, and you'll know peace. And the king, in that moment, because he had struggled so hard and cooked so intensely, was able to hear the sage's words. And with that, in that moment, his identification with his individualized self dissolved. And he found himself in a state of complete non-dual samadhi, ecstatic, at peace, completely, completely at one with consciousness. And he stayed in that state for who knows how long. But when he opened his eyes, when he came out of that samadhi and returned to his sense of his physical existence, he saw standing before him, instead of the sage, his queen, Chudala. He said, "What are you doing here?" Chudala said, "I was the sage." She said, "She explained, I knew you would never listen to me. I knew you had to do your own practice. So I came to you as this sage and helped you through the last stages. And then I was the vehicle for the grace, the awakening that came to you." And he said, she said, "The ridiculous thing is that you could have realized this at the very moment you heard this teaching from that wandering holy man 15 years ago if you just recognized what it is that you had to renounce." And at this moment, the king just got the whole thing. He saw how blind he'd been. He saw how necessary the process had been. He saw the state of his wife, and the two of them embraced, and this is the kicker. At this moment, he said to her, "Okay, now that I've realized the truth, I'm just going to stay here in the forest and meditate all day long." She said, "No, you can't do that. You have to come back to the kingdom, and we'll rule the kingdom, and our state of awareness will expand out to include everyone in the kingdom." And that's what they did. The king and Chudala lived for hundreds of years because he had also acquired those powers. And they ruled a kingdom that was filled with peace and happiness. And the story ends by saying, even the birds in the trees sang, "Soham, I am that, I am Shiva." So the Yoga Vashishta is all about living your life through the power of satsang, through the power of the company of the teachings, of the true teachings, which tell you not that you should give up your life, but that you should give up your identification with your roles, and that through sama, through pacifying the wanderings of the mind, through satsanga, through holding the teaching, through vichara, the ceaseless intention to inquire into the truth of yourself, into your own mind, into your own body, into your own actions, into the places where the limiting ego and the conceptual mind get stuck, with the intention of dissolving them, and through the practice of santosha, of acceptance of what is, really with that profound truth that is in fact the motto of AA, that incredibly brilliant recognition of paradox, that you accept the things that can't be changed, change the things that can, and have the wisdom to know the difference. And in those, in that life with those four gatekeepers, your life really does become the unfolding of the bliss of consciousness, even in the midst of ups and downs and pleasure and pain and sickness and aging and eventually death. You know who you are. So, with love, we're going to bring this session to a close. And you'll be receiving a homework assignment and also an audio, which will come to you tomorrow, as well as a homework assignment. And I hope you have a beautiful and brilliant, ecstatic, meditative journey this week, as well as a beautiful and ecstatic practice of the chakra in your day-to-day life. And we'll end with the chant, which reminds us that we are not anything that can be measured. We are consciousness and bliss. We are that divine being that lives through and as every particle of this universe and all the universes, known and unknown. So let your awareness flow with the breath. And as the breath flows in and out through the body, allow yourself to enter the breath. And let it fill your body and expand out. Knowing that you are that consciousness which has become the breath.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचिन्तानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वे न च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातून वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवो चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखं न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेद न यज्ञ. अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं. अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मे चिदानम्
love.